This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
One minute after midnight in New York City, you are tuned to listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. That was a rebroadcast of the evening news, followed by an observation from King Crimson way back in 1968. They recorded that song, and in reference to the obvious events in the news then in Vietnam, they included the line, "Innocents raped in napalm fire." This from the Financial Times of yesterday, January 5th. Israel denies white phosphorus shelling. Israel denied claims Monday night that it had used white phosphorus shells in its assault on the Gaza Strip, resisting claims that the Israeli military had contravened international conventions by using the weapons in heavily populated areas. The front pages of many Western newspapers on Monday showed a picture of Israeli shells with the distinctive white-shaped plumes exploding over Gaza. The picture prompted some Western experts to claim that the shells contained white phosphorus, a munition that Israel admitted using in fighting Hezbollah in Lebanon in 2006. The Israeli Defense Forces were planning on Monday night to put out a statement insisting that the shells pictured across the world's media did not contain white phosphorus, a substance that causes severe skin burns. The IDF said in a statement, quote, "IDF forces operate according to international law, including the use of weapons and ammunition," end quote. However, IDF officials refused to specify exactly what kind of substance was being used in the shells. Some military experts insisted that, judging from the pictures, some form of white phosphorus may have been in use. Although I can say with 100% certainty that these are classic white phosphorus rounds, they appear to have some form of although I can't say with 100% certainty that these are classic white phosphorus rounds, they appear to have some form of white phosphorus content, said Charles Heyman, former editor of Jane's World Defense. If that's the case, this is bad news, and the Israelis will lose out in terms of their international standing, quote unquote. According to Dr. Sandra Bell, an associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London, white phosphorus is regularly used in battlefield situations and has been employed, for example, by U.S. forces in Iraq. Quote, "These shells can be used as an effective smokescreen to obscure the advance of ground forces," she said. "They can also be used to illuminate very large areas of a battlefield at night." Dr. Bell said the use of white phosphorus shells in a battlefield situation was legal, and that there was no blanket ban under international law on their use as a smokescreen or for illumination. However, she noted that, according to the Geneva Convention, these substances are banned as a weapon of war in civilian areas because they burn skin. If the munitions were proven to contain white phosphorus, this could open Israel up to criticism because the Gaza Strip is densely populated. So, innocents raped with white phosphorus fire, thus it would appear. Once again, that's from the Financial Times of yesterday, January 5th. Or if you believe that the day starts at midnight, that would actually be the day before yesterday, because we're now 5 minutes into January 7th as the bombs continue to fall on the Gaza Strip. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade with me, Bill Weinberg. And, it's pretty clear what we're all going to be talking about tonight. Here, let's cut to our opening music. now that I played the time-killing music, which happened to be all too appropriate. Here, let's hear something from the land of Palestine.
أحد يعلم من الآتي في الدور غدا لا أحد يعلم من الآتي في الدور غدا سماء المخيم عابسة أحلامه مكتوبة على كل جدار أطفال المدينة يلهون بلعبة الموت قرب الشعار لا أحد يعلم لا أحد يعلم لا أحد يعلم أبطال حكايات النهار نعرفهم في نشرة المساء وناس عاديون يسرقون العناوين للحظة ويرحلون بعيدا ويرحلون بعيدا في زحمة الأسماء والأحداث والأخبار ولا أحد يعلم لا أحد يعلم لا أحد يعلم لا أحد يعلم لا أحد يعلم ولكني أعلم أعلم أن الراحلين غدا إنما
Amal Mercus with her song La Ahada Yalam translates as no one knows. No one knows whose turn it will be tomorrow. The skies above the refugee camp are gray, dreams hastily scrawled on the wells, on the walls. Beneath the slogans, the children play, the children from the city play their game of death. No one knows, no one knows. The heroes of today are announced dead on the evening news, ordinary people making the headlines for a few seconds, only to vanish without a trace in the current of another day's events. No one knows, no one knows. but I know that tomorrow's victims will bring a new dawn closer. We certainly do hope so. We'll be hearing more of Amal Mirkus later on this evening. And, well, perhaps we'll consider taking phone calls later on this evening as well. I've got a few things to say about the situation in Gaza. Largely in response to things which I've heard over the media generally and also over the airwaves of WBAI, which have been pretty atrocious. Things that I've heard from both sides, so to speak, and this is not to say that I am purporting to occupy a middle ground, because I don't think there is any middle ground here. And first and foremost, the most obvious thing which needs to be said loud and clear is that a massacre is being perpetrated against the people of Gaza. There is absolutely no justification for it. Some of the arguments which have been raised on the other side, I'm also going to have to address a little bit later on, but let's start with the arguments which we've heard from, in defense of Israel's aggression, which is, criminal by any standard. And unfortunately, some of those arguments have issued forth from the mouth of the mayor of the city which we inhabit. Michael Bloomberg, who, as we know, made a very high-profile tour of Ashkelon and Sderot, the two Israeli towns which have been within reach of Hamas's rockets. And he was there with Police Commissioner Ray Kelly and Representative Gary Ackerman of Queens. And, you know, from their perspective, you would think that there was some kind of rough equivalency here of, you know, what's been happening in Ashkelon and Sderot and what's been happening in Gaza. And, of course, we know that there isn't. On the Israeli side, thus far, since the offensive began, there's been four dead, one of which was a soldier. On the Palestinian side, there's upwards of 600 dead, at least by conservative estimates, I would say, 20% of them civilians, probably much, much higher. Sort of depends on how you count. I mean, some of the dead would be officials in the Hamas de facto government in Gaza. But civilian officials, for the most part, so I would say that they constitute civilians. I would say that probably the 20% figure is way too low. But that's the one which the United Nations is using. And 160 children have been killed in Gaza. So just before Bloomberg left for Israel, he made a statement at City Hall where an Israeli diplomat had brought along a shattered Hamas rocket. He brought it from Israel to City Hall to sort of make a statement. And Bloomberg forthrightly defended everything which Israel is doing, said, quote, "There's no such thing as a measured response to terrorism, period," end quote, in a reference to all of the international criticism which has been mounting against Israel. And that's a really, stop and think about it, that's quite a statement. There's no such thing as a measured response to terrorism, period, quote unquote. Well, Your Honor, you might want to consider reading the Geneva Conventions, because the Geneva Conventions make quite clear that under international law, there certainly is a measured response to terrorism. Protocol 1, Article 51, defines indiscriminate attacks as those which are not directed against a specific military objective, or those which use a method of attack that cannot be directed at or limited to a specific military objective. This includes area bombardment, where the number of clearly separated military objectives are treated as a single military objective, and where there is a similar concentration of civilians or civilian objects. This also includes attacks where the expected incidental loss of civilian life or damage to civilian objects is excessive to the military advantage anticipated. Okay, that's all from Protocol 1, Article 51, Sections 5 through 5B of the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which also states, of course, that indiscriminate attacks are prohibited. Furthermore, Protocol 1, Article 57 states that if it becomes apparent that an objective in an attack is not a military one, or if that attack could cause incidental loss of civilian life or damage to civilian objects, then the attack must be called off. So this quite obviously applies to the Israeli assault on Gaza, which is one of the most densely inhabited areas in the world. So even if it was only rocket launch sites which were being hit, the Israeli bombardment would still be clearly illegal under the Geneva Conventions. But of course, we know that's not the case. We know that schools have been hit, mosques have been hit, media outlets, television stations have been hit. So, the perverse irony here is that, of course, what Bloomberg is doing is he's using precisely the logic of terrorism. The notion that, you know, our cause is so important as to abrogate the norms of conventional morality. Precisely the logic of terrorism. I'm only invoking it because he invoked it. Precisely the logic which was used here in New York on September 11th of 2001. Precisely the same logic. So this is just, a case of the paradoxical unity of opposites. Counterterrorism, ostensible or so-called counterterrorism, using precisely the same logic as terrorism. So there is no defense. I want to make that clear right from the stop. There is no conceivable defense for what Israel is doing in Gaza. Another point which has been made, including by callers to this radio station. We get a strange lot calling into this radio station, I must say. But among those who, I don't know why they're listening to WBAI, they must just be gluttons for punishment. But among the apologists for the Israeli aggression who have actually called in to WBAI, one of the points which they have made is that Hamas started it and that Israel is only reacting. And I hate to tell you guys, but that is not the case. Now, you may not like this fact, but unfortunately it happens to be a fact, which is that it was Israel that broke the truce. The rockets started falling on the Hamas rockets started falling on Israeli territory. Only subsequent to an Israeli attack on a on what was dubbed in the Israeli press a so-called ticking tunnel, which is to mean a one of the tunnels which Hamas has apparently dug under the border of Gaza for smuggling in war material, you know, weapons, explosives from Egypt, and that eventually could be, you know, used against Israel. Now, as we all know, Hamas had called a Hamas and Israel had agreed to a 6-month ceasefire back in June, brokered by Egypt, and this was maintained until on election night here in the United States, on the very night that Barack Obama was elected here in the United States, and the world's media was completely distracted here, reading from Israel's Ynet news agency now. IDF leaves Gaza after op, 6 gunmen killed. IDF troops have completed their operation in the Gaza Strip and are currently preparing to leave the Hamas-ruled Palestinian territory. 2 soldiers were moderately wounded and 4 others sustained light injuries from a mortar shell. They were evacuated to Soroka Medical Center in Beersheba for treatment. For the first time since the ceasefire took effect in June, IDF forces operated deep in the Gaza Strip Tuesday. Tuesday meaning election night, November 5th. In a bid to collapse a tunnel located 250 meters from the border and which terror groups intended to use for kidnapping Israeli soldiers. Okay, so that was the perceived rationale. Palestinian sources reported that 6 gunmen were killed in the clashes that ensued during the operation, and several others, including a female bystander, were injured. The force arrived at the structure at the Al-Bureji refugee camp, which the tunnel had been dug in adjacent to. Palestinian gunmen were alerted to the soldiers' presence, and when they arrived at the scene, a fierce gun battle ensued. Shortly afterwards, a loud explosion occurred, which toppled the structure. The army said the intensity of the blast was due to a large amount of explosives stored in the building, adding that the building was probably booby-trapped ahead of time, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's a statement from the IDF saying that they're committed to maintaining the ceasefire even as they broke it. I'm not going to read any further. Obviously, an exercise in Orwellian logic. So, whether in fact the tunnel was booby-trapped and whether in fact there were explosives in the tunnel is sort of irrelevant to the question of who broke the ceasefire. Because, I mean, we can assume that, you know, there's both sides are going to be preparing for the eventuality of the ceasefire ending. But it's simply a matter of historical record that the ceasefire was broken. Ceasefire, which had been in place since June, was broken on the night of November 4th by Israel in an armed incursion, an armed covert incursion into Gaza. And it was subsequent to that that when the ceasefire ended, the 6-month ceasefire, which began in June, ended, that Hamas said that they were not going to renew it, and began firing rockets, and Israel responded with this massive and disproportionate retaliation. And once again, this question is almost irrelevant, because even if Israel had not been the first to break the ceasefire, their retaliation would still be illegal under international law, as being, you know, clearly disproportionate and indiscriminate, contrary to the Geneva Conventions. But once again, simply a matter of historical record that it was Israel which broke the ceasefire. So this is, you know, my response to the calls which we've got mostly on some of the late night shows here at BAI that, well, we can't trust Hamas, they broke the ceasefire. It would be an abhorrent enough argument even if it were true. But it's not true. And likewise, it's not true what our mayor said, that there is no such thing as a measured response to terrorism. Under international law, there certainly is such a thing as a measured response to terrorism. And in fact, the very reason that terrorism itself is illegal under international law is because it is not measured, quote unquote. It's disproportionate and it's indiscriminate. It's precisely why it's illegal. So, once again, this is merely reflecting the logic of one's enemy. And further evidence that as the secular civil progressive forces in the Middle East, which we support here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, say, it's further evidence of the peoples of the Middle East being caught between two poles of terrorism. So a part of me feels that these arguments are not even worth responding to. I suppose they're worth responding to only because they unfortunately have widespread currency in society and in the media at large. And WBAI sort of exists as the voice of the other side of the story. So I guess it's incumbent upon us to address these arguments. But ultimately, you know, I think that the large majority of our readers fall on the other side of the question. The large majority of our readers are appropriately appalled at what's happening in Gaza. And I think that particularly, you know, once you get out of the public affairs programming here at BAI and into the late night freeform programming where we take listener phone calls and we try to talk about ideas, that what's more important is to hash out our own points of unity as a movement and air our own internal divisions. And unfortunately, we have some. So before I move on to the next part of the discussion, I'm just going to say that I did attend the rally on Saturday up at Times Square, despite misgivings about doing so. And I think many of you will be aware, you longtime listeners will be aware of the nature of my misgivings. But I'm going to have a little something to say about it anyway, after we hear a little bit more from Amal Merkus. Okay, we just heard a very somber song from Amal about war. We'll hear a slightly more optimistic one that she wrote about peace. And then we'll continue this discussion optimistically in about a half an hour. We'll take listener phone calls. So please do stay tuned. This is listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. And this is Amal Merkus. Hulum, or a dream, was the name of that song. A white dove, a flower in its beak, it's in its eyes an unbreakable oath, never to let blood be shed between people. Flying high, the tapping of her wings create a scroll against the clouds that says if only people would open their eyes and drink from the same source, they would come closer together and leave off their fighting. Inshallah, Amal Mercus. Inshallah. Okay, well, let's see. Generally, let's see if I can get through everything which I want to say in the next 25 minutes so that we can take phone calls at the top of the hour. I would like very much to do that. But the people who are calling in now, write down what you have to say on a piece of paper and call back in 25 minutes because I'm not taking calls now, okay? So everybody who's calling in now, go away. All right. Generally, you know, I have sort of a rule that I do not attend any protests which are called by the Workers' World Party or any of its offshoots or front groups such as the International Action Center. There have now been two occasions in recent years in which I have broken that rule. Before this weekend, it was only one, and that was the May Day 2006 immigrants mobilization, because it seemed to me that that was so big and so grassroots an affair that the leadership, the ostensible leadership, that is to say the people who actually held the permit and controlled the stage and et cetera, they really were kind of lost in the sauce. Nobody was really paying much attention to them. So their efforts to, you know, seize control of the whole thing were basically futile. It was really much, much, much bigger than they were. So I marched in that and had a great time that day. And then I was sort of grappling with whether or not to attend the march for Gaza on Saturday, and ultimately I did go up there. I didn't think, well, I didn't stick around for the march, actually. I don't know if they actually ultimately did march, but there was, I was up there for the rally part of it, and I just couldn't quite bring myself to join. You know, I hung around and on the fringe and talked to people and took leaflets and see what people had to say. I couldn't quite bring myself to join for a couple of reasons, and one was that, you know, joining protests in New York City these days is just a real depressing affair, no matter how you slice it, because of the, as we've said on this on these airways many times before, the complete draconian nature of police control, where, you know, if you want to be a part of a street protest in New York City, a large one, that is, one of, you know, one of the ones where they actually coordinate with the police, get the rally ahead of time, you know, and the police seal off a couple of lanes of the avenue for you. In this case, it would have been 7th Avenue south of Times Square for maybe three blocks. It's, you know, you're completely enclosed by police barricades and phalanx of police on all sides, okay? All sides, all four sides. You know, every block is completely surrounded, is sealed off behind barricades, discreet, disconnected from both the public and from the protesters, you know, across the street up on the next block. So, I mean, it's like you're in jail practically, and the police can just, you know, move in on you and arrest you all anytime they want to, as they notoriously did en masse at the protest against the World Economic Forum back in just about this time of year, I believe, in 2002, if memory serves. It's gotten completely out of hand. It's made a mockery of the First Amendment, it's just a very, very uneasy feeling for me to be completely surrounded by police on all sides and just be a sitting duck for them to move in and arrest whenever they want to. So that was one reason why I confess I did not actually join the rally per se, but just kind of hung and observed on the fringe. The other reason is, you know, my ongoing misgivings about the people who, I hesitate to say leadership, because I know that people are going to take issue with that and say, oh, you know, I was there and I marched and, you know, the International Action Center are not my leader. And, all right, okay, there's some logic to that. There's some legitimacy to that argument. But you also have to take some responsibility for the fact that you are marching under their leadership to a certain extent, you know. I mean, you simply are. They're the ones who controlled the stage. They're the ones who had the sound permit. They're the ones who, negotiated the whole deal with the police, but put you behind the police barricades. You do have to take some responsibility for, you know, who actually called the rally that you're showing up at. And, particularly the fact that, they did such a good job of bringing out lots of NYC area Muslims. I just wonder how many of those Palestinians and other Muslim folk who showed up, who were behind the barricades, you know, understand that this is the same group which avidly supported mass murder of Muslims in Bosnia and Kosovo. And, you know, I'm sorry to harp on this, but it utterly, utterly undermines our moral credibility to be marching under this kind of leadership. And, I just don't understand how, I understand if certain people who showed up, you know, would say, well, I disagree with them on that. And some of them would disagree strongly. And others, well, just sort of disagree as an afterthought. But, you know, those of you who don't disagree with them, or the ones who are kind of lukewarm in your disagreement. You know, I just don't understand it. I mean, you know, now 600 have been killed in the Israeli assault on Gaza, and we all recognize that as an atrocity, which it is. 8,000 were killed in one afternoon in 1995 at Srebrenica. 8,000 Muslims by the very people that International Action Center was avidly supporting. Radovan Karadzic, Slobodan Milosevic and his, you know, minions and surrogates in Bosnia. And we're not supposed to care about this. We're not supposed to grapple with, you know, the fundamental contradiction. So that was another reason that I just couldn't quite bring myself to join the protest. And there were reasons beyond that where, I mean, okay, I would say, I've been thinking about this, the people who were addressing, whether it's chanting behind the police barricades out on 7th Avenue or talking to each other or talking, you know, beyond, hopefully not just to each other, but talking beyond our little sphere to the greater world at large over the airwaves of WBAI, I would say that, you know, they would probably fall into three categories. You know, on the worst are the people who were, you know, we could just call, you know, fundamentalist Zionists, who just think that, okay, you know, the Jews have got a cosmic real estate deed to the entire land of Palestine, and the Palestinians have no rights at all, and they're just usurpers. Now, you're never going to reach those people. There's no point in talking to those people. There's some people there's just no point in having a debate with, and those people fall into that category. There's no point in talking to those people. You're not going to sway them. Those people have to be defeated. Hopefully they can be politically defeated and not militarily defeated, but one way or another, they just have to be defeated. All right. Then, one ring closer to, you know, the people within our own sphere of, you know, the progressive community in New York City, whatever you want to call it. One ring closer are the people who are, you know, mostly Jews, but not all Jews. People who are sort of on the fence and are confused. And, you know, they may think that, you know, what's happening in Gaza is terrible, but they're also appalled by the rockets that Hamas has been launching from Gaza. And they've been appalled, you know, for all these years by the suicide bombings and so on. And they're just suffering from cloudy, muddled thinking on the whole question and been unduly influenced by the extremely imbalanced, you know, mainstream media reportage. But, you know, maybe some of them can be reached. Maybe some of them can be reached. You know, maybe enough of those people, not all of them can be reached, but maybe enough of a critical mass of those people, you know, have actually got enough of a fundamental sense of humanity and enough of a, you know, secular view of the world that they can be swayed by arguments and that they can be won over at least to the notion that Israel should abide by international law and that the Palestinians are have some kind of legitimate territorial rights. And again, you know, there's going to be a spectrum within this category. Some people can be reached and some people maybe can't be reached. And even the ones that can be reached, you know, it's a question of how far are they going to come in the right direction. But the more of them that can be reached and the more of them that can be swayed in the right direction, then, you know, that makes it a little bit more likely that the bloodshed can be brought to a halt sooner rather than later. And that ultimately there can be some kind of a political solution rather than a military solution, and that the people who cannot be reached and have to be defeated can be sufficiently isolated that they can be defeated politically and not defeated militarily. And that there will be less, you know, bad karma accrued on all sides for future generations, and some kind of, you know, lasting peace, knock on wood, or, you know, inshallah, ohala, maybe can actually be reached in our lifetimes or our children's lifetimes or our grandchildren's lifetimes, and that it isn't going to, you know, lead to Armageddon, which is certainly a possibility. All right, then the third category are the people who I would say constitute the big majority of the listeners of WBAI, the people who are appropriately appalled by what Israel is doing in Gaza, but are subject to their own oversimplifications and unhelpful dogmas, and are articulating their arguments in such a way as to alienate rather than to win over the people in the middle camp, who are the big, big, big majority, the people who maybe can be swayed, or maybe enough of them can be swayed sufficiently that we can avoid Armageddon. So, here, I'll try to keep brief, you know, my responses to some of what I saw at the rally and some of what I've heard over the airways of WBAI, which, okay, now I'm talking to the people who are basically on my side, but who I nonetheless have strong disagreements with. All right, I've already addressed one of my concerns, which is, you know, that sooner or later we're going to have to you know, really draw the line about the whole question of, you know, the morally bankrupt leadership, which keeps asserting itself. And, you know, all the time, you know, I keep saying, well, you know, I don't like, I keep hearing people saying, I don't like Workers' World either, but, and it's always but, you know, it's always but it's an emergency. Iraq, Gaza, whatever the emergency of the week happens to be. You know, I've been hearing this ever since the goddamn Panama invasion. Well, there's always going to be an emergency. You can't pretend that you've got a rule and then break it every time there's an emergency, because then the exception insidiously becomes the rule. And, you know, the rule isn't that, well, we don't like them, but we'll make an exception in an emergency. The rule is actually, well, yeah, they're the leadership of the movement, and we just put up with it. And I'm not saying there's any easy answers here, because I'm not, you know, going out and doing the hard work of organizing people. Okay, I'm just throwing tomatoes on the radio. I acknowledge this, okay? But somebody's got to throw these tomatoes, okay? I'm not being glib about it. I'm acknowledging that it's a real dilemma, but it is nonetheless a real dilemma. Let's have the discussion. Let's get it out in the open. Secondly, well, you know, there's one banner which I saw over and over and over again up at the rally, which I saw it in two distinct forms. One was sort of a mass-produced form where somebody actually printed up pictures of the Star of David in blue against a white background as it appears on the Israeli flag with an equal sign on a swastika. Well, you know, that's an imprecise formulation. But what's worse is that frequently, just as a sort of a shorthand, you know, the version which is not mass-produced, people just, you know, sort of, you know, do it at home with magic marker, is just the Star of David, not, you know, in blue against a white background as it appears on the Israeli flag, equals a swastika. Now, I understand that, you know, yes, the Star of David, unfortunately, is the symbol of the Israeli state. The Israeli state is certainly abrogating international law, as I said at the top of the show, and engaging in illegal aggression, as the Nazi state did. But nonetheless, the Star of David is not only the symbol of the Israeli state. And there have been lots of instances since World War II of governments which have abrogated international law and engaged in illegal aggressions, including, obviously, our own, but not only our own. Russia has done it repeatedly. Indonesia has done it. Arguably, the government of Sri Lanka is doing it right now against the Tamil territory in the north. And for some reason, this Nazi analogy does not get thrown around as promiscuously in those cases as it does in the case of Israel. Now, we should think about why that is. And, the Geneva Conventions in 1949 were passed in response to the Nazi aggression, but the worst of what the Nazis did is much, much, much worse than anything which has been done since then. There might be an exception here and there. It's hard to think of any. So, once again, I just question why why in the case of Israel this analogy is thrown around so promiscuously. And this leads us to some of the other things which I've heard over these airwaves, which is, is it even worth dwelling on this? Unfortunately, I think that this does represent a current of thought amongst BAI listeners. And this is stuff which I've heard from callers, not stuff which I've heard from producers, okay? And, BAI does sort of have this bad rap as the voice of anti-Semitism, blah, blah, blah. And to a certain extent, it's a bum rap, right? To a certain extent, we've been maligned. But to a certain extent, there's, you do hear a lot of pretty appalling stuff over these airways from time to time, more from callers than from producers. So, it might behoove us to, think about it and grapple with it. So, I heard more than one caller, unfortunately, say that what Israel is doing is worse than what the Nazis did. Well, it's just a ludicrous, ahistorical statement. And it isn't any exoneration to say that what Israel is doing is not worse than what the Nazis did. One caller actually said that no matter what, you can say what you want about Hitler, but at least he didn't invade Israel. Well, if you knew your history, you should, before you make such dogmatic statements, you should read your history. Israel didn't exist until after Hitler was long dead, okay? State of Israel came into existence in 1948, and Hitler was killed in 1945. World War II was over with. It wasn't any Israel back then. It was Palestine, okay? So, once again, exactly as I said about Bloomberg's comments about there's no such thing as a measured response to terrorism, it would be an abhorrent enough thing to say even if it were true. So that's, similarly my response to, you can say what you want about Hitler, at least he didn't invade Israel. It would be an abhorrent enough thing to say even if it were true. So, whoever it is that said that, whoever it is that called into another show on WBAI and said that, I really, really hope that you're listening tonight. Spend a little time in a library before you get on the air, okay? Jeez, okay. We're going to take phone calls in around, as soon as I get through my next point. Hopefully that'll be in around 5 minutes. Knock on wood. Ohala, inshallah. The number, a few people are calling already, but I'm going to give the number. It's 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. But I do have one more point to make, which is that, I hear over and over again this notion that this notion that, you know, the so-called Khazar thesis, that, that the Ashkenazim are not even really Jews, quote, unquote. Once again, I have the same response here. That would be an abhorrent enough thing to say, even if it were true. Now, in fact, you know, obviously this all goes back to Arthur Koestler's book, The 13th Tribe, in which, you know, he made the case that the Ashkenazim, that is to say the Jews of Central and Eastern Europe, contrary to the official histories, which is that they trace their roots back to the Jews who were expelled from Spain after the Catholic Reconquest, that in fact they trace their roots back to the Khazars, who were a Turkic tribe of Central Asia who established an empire in the east of what's now Russia and Ukraine back around the time of Charlemagne, and converted to Judaism, just basically for political purposes, because you know, you had the big powers of the day were the Empire of Charlemagne, which was Catholic, and the Byzantine Empire, which was Christian, Eastern Orthodox Christian, and the Caliphate of Baghdad, which was Muslim. So in order to sort of carve out a turf for themselves as you know, their own separate empire, they converted to Judaism. And Arthur Koestler makes a case that, in fact, this is, you know, after they were, after their empire was dispersed by the Russians and others, that a lot of them moved east into Eastern and Central Europe and became the Ashkenazim. Well, you know, it's a case. He wrote this book a long time ago, mind you. He wrote this book back in, I believe it would have been shortly after the founding of the State of Israel, actually, probably in the late 1940s, if memory serves. Let's see, I've got the book in front of me, looking for the copyright, but unfortunately, it's only giving me the copyright of the edition which I've got, which is the paperback edition. But he wrote it certainly. Anyway, he wrote it a good long while ago, right? He wrote it several decades ago, at least. Since then, there's been more research into the question. And in fact, you know, it's now thought by historians that the ethnogenesis of the Ashkenazim was rather more complicated than either the official history, as it were, or the Khazar thesis, and that there's elements of truth to both. And that the Khazars themselves had to get their Judaism from somewhere, right? So, and there were Jews, which in the initial diaspora, after the destruction of the Second Temple, probably did, you know, make their way north of the Byzantine Empire, north of the Roman Empire, as it was at the time. And that there was initial contact between the Khazars and the ancient Hebrews. And they had to get their Judaism from somewhere. They had to learn it from somewhere. They had to learn Hebrew from somewhere. So it's quite probable that there was intermarriage. So without, you know, disputing the Khazar thesis, it is likely that, in fact, there is some, you know, transmission between, you know, generation to generation to generation between the contemporary Ashkenazim and the ancient Hebrews. The ancient Hebrews, of course, would be a very small, very small part of the genetic admixture, which is the contemporary Ashkenazim, along with, you know, Turkic peoples such as the Khazars and Slavic peoples and Germanic peoples and so on. But, you know, this whole question is it's self-defeating, ultimately, because you're actually giving propaganda fuel to your enemies. Supposing that the Ashkenazim can trace a lineage back to the ancient Hebrews, and this whole question has gotten so polluted that, you know, there's actually like contending DNA studies which have been done by, you know, scientists which are sympathetic to Israel and scientists which are sympathetic to the Palestinians, either finding that, yes, there is the, you know, Kohanim DNA, the DNA which traces back to supposedly to the to the ancient priestly class of Israel in the contemporary Ashkenazim. I mean, the science itself has become politicized. And you're actually giving propaganda fodder to your enemy. Supposing that the Ashkenazim can trace a lineage back to the ancient Hebrews, does that mean that the Palestinians are not entitled to human rights? You know, you're loaning legitimacy to the enemy's arguments. All right? And, you know, this notion that the Ashkenazim aren't really Jews is really quite separate from this whole question of whether or not there's actually been, or whether or not there are actually genetic traces of the ancient Hebrews. Okay? Now, you have to understand the roots of Zionism if you're going to really understand Zionism and actually have the arguments to counter Zionism. And, you know, Zionism was a reaction to European, classical European anti-Semitism, quite obviously, right? Hopefully it's not necessary to belabor this point. So, you know, for centuries and centuries, Jews had been, in Europe had been forced into ghettos and, denied equal rights and, denied the right to own land and to sell property, et cetera, et cetera. Then, finally, you know, they begin to, officially attain equal rights in the period of so-called Jewish emancipation in the 19th century. And then, you know, you've got the big backlash in the 20th century, beginning with the Tsarist pogroms and then on through the Nazi Holocaust. And then, in the context of all of this, you know, you get this big mass exodus of Jews who basically say, to hell with this, you know, we've been told for all these centuries that we're not Europeans, and okay, fine, we're not Europeans, we're getting out of here. And they begin to establish colonies in Palestine, with, you know, Britain sort of cynically playing both sides between the Jews and the Arabs and promising the same land to both, and we all know that history. And in fact, many of the Jews who managed to escape the Holocaust did so by escaping to Palestine illegally and running a British blockade in order to do so. And, you know, then for various historical reasons, including, you know, I would argue, Western imperialism, deciding that it would be worthwhile to have an effective proxy in the Middle East to help police the region with its precious oil reserves, the State of Israel turns into a fairly militarized, aggressive, and in many ways illegal entity. And then in response to this, we're told that, and now I'm using we to mean Ashkenazim Jews, you know, oh, you don't really exist. You're just Germans who happen to have a different religion, or you're just Poles, or you're just Ukrainians, or you're just Romanians who happen to have a different religion. Well, that's clearly completely ahistorical, right? And the whole question of whether there's actually Kohanim DNA, you know, in my mitochondria is utterly irrelevant to the question of whether the Ashkenazim exist as a distinct people. And it's also irrelevant to the question of whether the Palestinians exist as a distinct people and are entitled to human rights. Not on the basis of who God gave a cosmic real estate deed to, but on the basis of their historical occupancy of the land for the past several centuries. And by the way, Arthur Koestler says as much in The 13th Tribe. Read the book. I'm going to read one page of The 13th Tribe. From the appendix, Some Implications, Israel and the Diaspora. Quote, while this book deals with past history, it unavoidably carries certain implications for the present and future. In the first place, I am aware of the danger that it might be maliciously misinterpreted as a denial of the State of Israel's right to exist. But that right is not based on the hypothetical origins of the Jewish people, nor the mythological covenant of Abraham with God. It is based on international law, i.e., on the United Nations decision of 1947 to partition Palestine, once a Turkish province, then a British-mandated territory, into an Arab and a Jewish state. Whatever the Israeli citizens' racial origins, and whatever illusions they entertain about them, Their state exists de jure and de facto and cannot be undone except by genocide. Without entering into controversial issues, one may add, as a matter of historical fact, that the partition of Palestine was the result of a century of peaceful Jewish immigration and pioneering effort, which provide the ethical justification for the state's legal existence. Whether the chromosomes of its people contained the genes of Khazar or Semitic, Roman or Spanish origin is irrelevant and cannot affect Israel's right to exist, nor the moral obligation of any civilized person, Gentile or Jew, to defend that right. Even the geographical origin of the native Israelis' parents or grandparents tends to be forgotten in the bubbling racial melting pot. The problem of the Khazar infusion 1,000 years ago, however fascinating, is irrelevant to modern Israel. End quote. All right, now there is much in the passage which I just read that I disagree with. Okay, the notion that partition of Palestine was a result of a century of peaceful Jewish immigration. Well, it wasn't always so peaceful. And particularly what happened in 1948 was not peaceful. And there was massive ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. So, you know, there's much in this passage which I disagree with. And I'm not a Zionist. I'm anti-Zionist. And I have been, as long as I've been, you know, old enough to understand what Zionism is, I've been anti-Zionist. But Arthur Koestler was not anti-Zionist. So those of you who resort to the Khazar thesis and Arthur Koestler's work in defense of your argument should really think twice, because the guy who wrote the book did not share your beliefs. And once again, you're giving propaganda ammo to the people who would argue that the Palestinians aren't entitled to human rights if the contemporary Ashkenazim, who, by the way, are now a minority in Israel. I mean, even most of the Jews in Israel are Sephardis or Mizrahis, not Ashkenazim. But people who argue that the Palestinians wouldn't be entitled to legitimate rights if it could be proven that the contemporary Jews are the heirs to the ancient Hebrews. Completely irrelevant. Just shooting yourself in the foot by making that argument. So, this also, people have quoted Einstein and other Jews of the time of Israel's establishment and some statements which they made in dissent of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians and purporting that they were opposed to the establishment of the State of Israel. Again, this is not historically true. Now, you know, we can think whatever we want, but people like Albert Einstein and Hannah Arendt and I.F. Stone, who were Jews who dissented back in the day, were not dissenting from the establishment of the State of Israel, and they were not dissenting from Zionism. They were dissenting from what they saw as excesses which delegitimized the Zionist project, such as the notorious massacre of the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin. There were many, many other such massacres which took place, which unfortunately were not as notorious. And a lot of historical work has been done since then by historians like Benny Morris, documenting that there was really much more widespread what we would now call ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians than was understood by many people in the outside world at the time. But we can think whatever we want today. But it's just disingenuous to argue that, Albert Einstein and the other Jews who dissented in the day were anti-Zionist and opposed the establishment of Israel, because it's not true. So, in Israel itself, progressives talk about post-Zionism, and they take the attitude that Zionism may have been necessary in 1948 when, there were all of these displaced people who, survivors of the Holocaust who had no place to go, and that Zionism was seen as an imperative of the survival of the Jewish people. But now that's no longer the case, and there has to be some kind of accommodation with the Palestinians. And so we should either have a single binational state with equal rights for all, a secular state with equal rights for all, or a two-state solution. But either way, it's time to move beyond Zionism. Now, I go further than that. I don't consider myself a post-Zionist. Well, for starters, because I was never a Zionist, so I couldn't be a post-Zionist. I've always opposed Zionism. And, you know, it seems to me that the Zionist project continues in the colonization of the West Bank and in what may be the reconquest of Gaza that we're witnessing at the moment. So it's necessary to continue to be anti-Zionist. Nonetheless, you know, if you're going to be anti-Zionist, you should have some appreciation of what Zionism is and how it came about. So, all right, we've got 20 minutes left, and for the remaining 20 minutes, we're going to plunge into the unknown and take listener phone calls if anybody has anything to say. 212-209-2900 is the number. 212-209-2900. WBAI, you're on the air.
Am I on the air?
Yes, that's why I just said you're on the air.
Oh, I didn't hear you. I'm sorry. Okay, I just wanted to know, when did the IAC come out and say, let's kill Muslims?
Well, they're not so impolitic as to come out and say, let's kill Muslims. But they say that the Srebrenica massacre didn't happen, or that the victims deserved it, or et cetera, et cetera. They're very weaselly about their arguments, but they were avidly rooting for Slobodan Milosevic and Radovan Karadzic throughout the wars of in Bosnia and Kosovo in the 1990s.
Well, if they didn't come out and say, let's kill Muslims, maybe...
What didn't you understand? They were avidly rooting for the people who were killing the Muslims. They're not going to be so impolitic as to come out and say, let's kill Muslims, okay? Ehud Barak is not now saying, let's kill Muslims, is he?
Let's not make misstatements, okay?
I didn't make any misstatements.
But you did.
No, I didn't.
You said they rooted for the killing of Muslims.
They absolutely did. They rooted for the killing of Muslims. I make no bones about it.
When did they do that?
Excuse me?
When did they do that?
Over and over and over again.
When?
Throughout the 1990s, throughout the war in Bosnia. Beginning in 1991 and continuing on through 1996, they repeat and even after that, because they continued to say that, you know, all the charges against Milosevic were trumped up and there wasn't really any massacre at that Srebrenica, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, could you point me to a source?
Yeah, go to the IAC website.
I have been there several times.
Well. All right, well, you know, I also wrote something about it, which is on my own website. Go to WorldWar4Report.com and go to the back issues page and find the piece that I wrote on the politics of the anti-war movement.
So if I go to that IAC site and your site, I'm going to find something that says, rah-rah, let's kill all Muslims.
No, you weren't listening to anything I just said, so we're going to move on. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi, great show.
Thank you.
Hasn't been a tradition in a Jewish history since the Maccabees in 144 A.D., the last revolt, of always return to Jerusalem, or return to, you know, the country.
So?
So I think there's a great justification for the establishment of Israel. Now, what I'm trying to say is, isn't Zionism connected with that belief system?
Well,
almost 1,800 years.
Well, of course it is, but I think that it's absolutely ludicrous to be basing a contemporary 20th century or 21st century belief system on the notion that God gave a particular people a cosmic real estate deed to a particular piece of real estate. I think that's abhorrent.
Right. So, if Jewish people did have an Israel to return to, what would be their future? Would they still be in a diaspora, or there wouldn't be a homeland?
Well, you know, this is a pretty important question, actually, and I'll say that, you know, one of the reasons, you know, I wanted to say this, I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to say it. One of the reasons that I'm anti-Zionist, well, the first and foremost reason, of course, that I'm anti-Zionist is because, you know, Zionism has been an atrocity for the Palestinians and disappropriated them of their lands and reduced them to refugees and second-class citizens in their homeland. That's the first and foremost reason which, that I'm opposed to Zionism. The second reason, however, that I'm opposed to Zionism is because it's bad for the Jews. And I think that, the Jews have allowed themselves to once again replicate the historical pattern of anti-Semitism by serving as surrogates and proxies for imperial power, and that ultimately it perpetuates the pattern of anti-Semitism. And if you're going to really be opposed to Zionism, by the way, I'll point out that that means taking the question of anti-Semitism seriously and being committed to opposing it here in the diaspora. And that's what I do. I oppose anti-Semitism here in the diaspora. My homeland is New York City. Okay, my homeland is not Palestine. My homeland is not Israel. My homeland is New York City. And I am going to fight in what I believe to be the enlightened self-interest of Jews here in New York City by opposing anti-Semitism here in New York City. And I understand why a lot of Jews gave up in the 1940s and earlier on opposing opposing anti-Semitism in Europe. I understand the historical reasons why many of them gave up. But, you know, now it's 40 or 50 years later or more, and it's a different world, and I don't believe, and ultimately I believe that Israel is a false hope for the Jewish people, and that an ingathering of the Jews onto a piece of stolen land is a sure recipe for disaster, and more disaster, and more disaster, and more disaster for the Jewish people. And that ultimately the challenge is to fight anti-Semitism in the diaspora and to demand a dignified place for Jews in the diaspora. So that's my answer to you. I hope that it makes some sense. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yep.
I have this to say. It's Tom from the Bronx here. Regardless of who pushed whose grandmother off the cliff many years ago for the insurance money, the fact is you have to look to the future. And the way to do that is to create a new country in the Mideast, to buy a major portion of the Sinai Peninsula and physically rehabilitate it with a lot of money, and they can create a true homeland for the Palestinians in there. As far as Israel is concerned.
Oh, okay, all right, right. Put the Palestinians off into the deserts of the Sinai. Come on, get real. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio, please. Pseudo solution, another bogus pseudo solution heard from. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
Okay.
I've been listening to your comments, and I've been listening to you, the historical facts that you've been getting. I mean, not for nothing. I mean, what's done is done, and we have to look forward towards the future or something to figure out these problems that we have.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's to sit here and discuss, you know, the 1948 UN Peace Accord, you know, how they placed the Israelis there via the Exodus from Europe, and where we're living in today's world, I mean, you can't do anything about what's done.
Right, I agree, of course.
We have to do something about the future.
Right, I mean, but you have also... Hang on a second. You have to understand how we got here in order to do something about the future.
You know, we understand. I mean, I think the whole world understands how we got here because the non-Israeli, the non-Jewish community makes it very clear all the time how the Israelis or the Jews have gotten to where they are right now in Palestine. But I mean, it's the same thing like the Indians selling Manhattan for $24 and a couple of blankets. I mean, are they going to come back and tell America right now, listen, you robbed us, you got a super deal? We want it back? I think.
Well, no. Hang on a second. Okay. Now, yeah, we're living on stolen land here in New York City. We have to take responsibility for this. Every you know, square inch of American soil is stolen land, and we have to take responsibility for this. And there are concrete ways in which we can take responsibility for this. We can, make a stand for justice for the Native Americans. We can demand that the treaty rights be upheld. We can demand that unceded lands be returned in one form or another. Now, nobody is saying that this is going to, you know, entail mass repatriation of every American citizen back to the lands that his or her ancestor hailed from, whether it's in, England or Ireland or Italy or Poland or Africa or China or wherever. Nobody is saying that, okay? But, certainly there are cases which are being waged in the courts in New York State right now over the lands which were stolen from the Iroquois Confederacy, which were never ceded by any treaty, which the inheritors of the Iroquois Confederacy, which continues to exist today, are demanding some kind of sovereignty or control over. Okay, and it has to do with taxation, and it has to do with access to undeveloped lands. And it isn't about, you know, turning back the clock on history. That obviously cannot be done. But certainly, if you follow these issues, you know, these struggles are being waged in the courts from coast to coast. Land rights, water rights, all goes back to treaty rights. So we can certainly take a stand, and we must take a stand in defense of the rights of the Native Americans. Just as as Israelis of conscience are taking a stand for the rights of the Palestinians. And I should point out, by the way, that on the same day that we were rallying up at Times Square, there were 10,000 Israelis who marched in Tel Aviv against the bombardment of Gaza. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air. You're on the air. If you don't speak...
Yeah. Hello? Hello?
You're on the air.
Yes, hello?
You're on the air. Oh, well. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Good evening.
Good evening.
One thing I want to know, how is Israel supposed to keep a Jewish state? Are they going to stop all people that are not Jews from becoming citizens there forever? I mean, that's a small piece of land there. And to think that they want a Jewish state forever, it baffles me, because I don't think it could happen.
Well, look, it's not going to happen. It's a matter of demographic reality that Israel is not going to remain a Jewish state, a Jewish majority state, any more than the United States is going to remain a white majority state. And, you know, Jews in Israel are going to have to deal with this reality, just like whites here in the United States are going to have to deal with this reality, one way or another.
You said something about ethnic cleansing. Now, there's a lot of Palestinians hoping one day that they could ethnic cleanse their land and get the Jews out of there. Do you know that?
Well, quite obviously.
Do you think they could do it?
Do I think they can do it? I don't have a crystal ball, but I think that the only hope is for some kind of notion of coexistence and, you know, some kind of redressing of the wrongs which were done to the Palestinians and continue to be done, quite obviously, to the Palestinians, and creating some kind of either two-state solution or some kind of, you know, binational single-state solution with equal rights for all. You know, that's the only hope. You know, otherwise it's just going to be this horrible cycle of vengeance which is going to go on forever.
I'll ask you one more thing before I go. Could you tell me what you meant about the people supporting Bosnia? Because I was wondering if you support, for instance, the Iraq War or the Vietnam War or even the World War One or Two or whatever, does that mean that because you support one side, you approve of the killing?
No, absolutely not. I opposed the bombardment of Serbia by NATO unequivocally. Here, I found the piece. If you want to read the piece which explains all of this, it's on my website. Go to WW4, that's a number 4, report.com/node/1337, okay? The piece entitled The Politics of the Anti-War Movement and the Intractable Dilemma of International Answer by yours truly, Bill Weinberg. It states, repeatedly throughout the Bosnian War of the 1990s, Workers' World portrayed reports of atrocities and mass rape by the Serb forces as, quote, imperialist lies, unquote. Ramsey Clark, the visible leader of the International Action Center, is a founder of the International Committee to Defend Slobodan Milosevic and has also provided legal representation for some accused of participating in the 1994 Rwanda genocide. He has more recently volunteered for Saddam Hussein's legal team. Merely providing legal representation, even for mass murderers, is legitimate, but Clark has gone beyond legal work to political advocacy and has consistently followed the Workers' World Party line in both. In the 1990s, he repeatedly traveled to Bosnia to meet with Serb rebel leader Radovan Karadzic, today a fugitive from war crimes charges. Et cetera, et cetera. There's more to read if you want to read it. Go to The Politics of the Anti-War Movement. It's on my website, worldwar4report.com/node/1337. Okay? WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak up.
Yes. I just like to say my idea was the best idea.
Oh, no. You again? No, no, no. You just got one chance to be unhelpful. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, let me turn down my radio.
Please do.
Okay, I just did. I'm always confused by this issue because I hear your take and I process information. I'm not stupid, you know, but hopefully. But I have things that I want to comment on and I want your take on them, perhaps for clarification, all right? I mean, 6 months ago when Israel had pulled out of certain territories, that's exactly when Hamas started building underground tunnels and amassing weapons. They've been throwing rockets at Israel since April, you know.
Excuse me, point of clarification.
Go ahead.
They hurled rockets at Israel from April until June when the ceasefire took effect, and then they stopped until the ceasefire ended. And,
right.
by that point, Israel had already violated the ceasefire.
All
right, and yes, it's true. I start with the first thing I said at the beginning of the show, and secondly, well, yes, of course they're going to continue. It's a ceasefire. It isn't an actual peace deal. So of course we're going to continue to amass weapons as best they can, and so on. And Israel hasn't disarmed. Has Israel disarmed?
Okay, I'm listening. The other thing that which I need clarification on, because it gets confusing, I think, for everybody, is that Mubarak was speaking to Assad recently, to ask Assad to talk to Hamas, to at this point stop throwing rockets into Israel, so that Israel, you know, would be forced into a corner and therefore would cease its, you know, its action right now. And Assad said, no, I won't do that, and neither will Hamas cease from throwing rockets into those towns as I speak now. So, I mean, what does one make of that?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that that's Barack's position. I thought that Barack was actually calling for a ceasefire on both sides.
Well, Mubarak, not Barack.
No, I'm sorry, Mubarak is what I meant. Egypt's Mubarak.
Yeah, asked Assad to tell Hamas to stop with the rockets for a while.
Well, you'll have to send me some documentation on that because
it was a conference they had like yesterday, and Assad said no way. So you know, but that just came out. That was in the New York Times.
Oh, all right, I misunderstood you. All right, so Mubarak was calling for Assad to put pressure on Hamas.
Right.
Right.
And Hamas said no, we're not going to stop throwing rockets in there.
All right, Hamas said that.
Yeah. Well, no, Assad said that. To get in the middle of this, and Hamas is still throwing rockets at Israel. See, that's the thing. As long as it's at least a visible pretense, if you will, you know, the way it appears, you know what I mean, for Israel to continue, shall we say?
Well, look, I mean, once again, even if you're going to loan some legitimacy to the notion of a response, I mean, putting aside the whole question that the very territory which these Hamas rockets are reaching, you know, the people in Hamas were forced from that very land. They were forced from Ashkelon and Sderot in 1948, and that's why they're in refugee camps in Gaza today. But even putting aside that, and just, you know, if you want to loan some legitimacy to the notion of an Israeli military response to the rocket attacks, you can't justify this kind of, you know, massive, disproportionate, indiscriminate bombardment. I mean, it's just, I'm sorry, there is no argument which can be made in favor of it, regardless of what, do the math, 4 dead to 600 dead. A territory which has already been, you know, under siege and in pretty horrific conditions already, and then to be coming under this kind of, you know, bombardment. Not a syllable which can be raised in defense of this, okay? And I'm not, that doesn't mean that Hamas are a bunch of angels or that they don't bear any responsibility in the dynamic, okay? That's not what I'm saying, and that's...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.